Muller House Meeting, Friday afternoon, 23rd September 1977. In order to release ourselves from our subhuman into a truly human condition, it is essential to know and to understand our own organism, the body-mind organism as we commonly call it, but which would more accurately be described by saying the psychophysical organism. To know and to understand mind in its true and full meaning, and to see as clearly as we can the relationship of pure mind to the organism, and to try and sense with the deepest part of our spiritual being and consciousness the meaning of transcendence, or the one total reality. You will notice I used the word subhuman in connection with the whole of mankind as it is today. I am not using the word subhuman in a derogatory sense. I am using that word to suggest that mankind, in the course of its development and evolution, not only physically, but mentally and spiritually, is still only part of the way out of the purely animal state towards the fully human state. What is the meaning of this word human? Do we really understand the word? Let us first look at that verse in the first chapter of Genesis, towards the end of it. And Elohim, usually translated as God, and Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. And you may remember yesterday, I think, I suggested that we should add one word to that and say, let us make man in our own living image. Because the word image generally makes us feel that we are non-living, that we are like fossils or stones. And that would clash with the idea which is expressed in one of the early commandments, thou shalt make no graven image, but worship only the Lord God. Now relate this to the statement, and Elohim said, let us make man in our own living image. You may remember I said also that in the Hermetic teachings, as they have come down to us in their Hellenistic form, that God is referred to as All Father Mind. It's a very interesting use of the word mind in the writings of Hermes Trismegistus, thrice greatest, as he is called. Because this statement links up the Buddhistic presentation very intimately with this Hellenistic presentation of the ancient Egyptian teachings. It gives us a hint that perhaps what we tend to regard as different cultures and different religions are not so different from each other, especially where their origin was concerned. It is not unlikely that the supreme religious truths of life were known all over the civilized world of the past, anything between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, because the similarities in the deep teachings are so great that the superficial differences born of the differences ethnically, that is the race type, culturally, geographically and historically, are only very slight. Those differences don't matter so much. They enrich the fundamental reality of the great truths because they present variety. If everybody talked in just the same way, the same things, we would perhaps lose interest, even if only a little bit. So it is just as well to have certain differences in expression, a variety of expression, which enriches our understanding, provided, as I have said so far yesterday and this morning, we keep a completely open mind and a sensitive, open heart to everything. Now, let us look at this word, mind. Let us look at this word, man. Man is derived from the Sanskrit root man, which means, if you look at the dictionary, to think. But no dictionary can give you the true meaning of this word man. We have no words in the language to define, which means to confine, therefore, to limit. That which is transcendent, that which is infinite, unimaginable, quite beyond our scope, constituted as we are at present, to look into the nature of that which is our fundamental source and our ultimate goal. We don't know it. We are somewhere in between. But supposing we translate man as meaning mind in its transcendental sense. And you may recall, we talked a little bit about this transcendental aspect of mind in relationship to our limited brains and the brain processes, which are expressed in what we commonly call thought and speech. Those are the two main forms of expression, the conceptual form and the verbal form. Now, the conceptual and verbal form is limited. It is limited by us ourselves for the simple reason that we are limited. And we soon reach our limits. And not only are we limited, but we are, on the whole, in a state of considerable imperfection, considerable confusion and muddlement. If we were not, our whole lives would be perfectly harmonious and the expression of divinity itself. But are they? Are our lives like that? They are not like that. So you may recall that I suggested, and quite freely admitted, that this is an arbitrary presentation by me, but it helps us to gain a better understanding of the whole situation. Remember, we distinguished between mind in its transcendental sense as that expression of creative energy which brings cosmos into being out of chaos. Remember, that is what we tried to understand. And we used the word psyche, which is rooted in the physical brain and nerves and is dependent upon the electrochemistry of the whole body, ductus glands particularly, and so forth. We distinguish psyche from mind. Now, our ordinary meaning of the word to think, the thought process, is merely a stream of words which goes through the brain. It has no relationship to mind in its transcendental sense as this energy which is creative. And this energy, being universal, being infinite, immeasurable, beyond space and time and matter, is without any character, without any qualities that you or I could ascribe to it. Because all the qualities and character that we ascribe to anything whatsoever is an expression of the picture in our brains made by our senses and our brain activity of the impact of reality as it is upon our organism through the senses. And you see, these are faulty. The organism itself is still advancing. You remember yesterday I suggested we take an imaginary journey backwards into the past through time and try and imagine that state when our primordial animal ancestor was just beginning to change and took millions of years to change and become the men and women that we see on the globe today. If that animal knew photography and could have left some photographs of it, it would have been a great revelation to see the changes in the structure which took place. And do remember that every change in structure is associated with change in function, change in capacity, change in sensitivity, the sensitivity grows, the sensitivity which is potential there, it grows, it develops, and the change in refinement and the power to respond more and more rightly to our experiences in life, to the impact of the reality of the world upon us. Now all this is very, very important. Now you will see that if Elohim created man, and man means derived from the word from which also the word mind is derived, if Elohim created us in his own image, then God in his transcendence is the potentiality within man. So we see that there is an extraordinary, profound, indescribable relationship between man, you and I, as we appear ordinarily, a perishable, mortal, finite creature making mistakes. There is a tremendous potentiality hidden in us which is slowly, slowly coming out. And this potentiality, which comes out slowly through time and space, exists in its full power, in its eternity and its transcendence, beyond any limitation of space and time and matter within us. So, we can say that you or I, the living person, is the full embodiment of the eternal, the absolute. Use the word God if you like. Use Brahman, use Atma. Use the Hellenistic all God, the All Father mind. Use any word you like. But that ultimate reality, which we may have in our profoundest vision, is completely embodied in us. We may say, but if it is completely embodied in us, why aren't we manifesting it now? This is where the marvelous play of the creative activity of transcendence comes in. We can only suggest, and the profoundest teachings, both in the Kabbalah and in the Veda, the Kabbalah, which is the original root of the entire Semitic tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, and the Veda, which is the root of the Hindu-Buddhist tradition, both these traditions suggest that this indescribable ultimate reality, this creative energy, which in its utter freedom is a quiescent pulsation, it's a peaceful pulsation there by itself. It constricts itself, and in the constriction it gives rise to form and shape, and with that there arises simultaneously matter, space and time. It's an extraordinary thing for people anything between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago at least to say such a thing. Modern science, the most recent modern science of just about 15 years ago onwards, has now suggested this integration between matter, space, time, that they are not separate. Matter is not something which is inside space-time, like an object, say, a basket of fruits, so many fruits inside a basket. But all three exist simultaneously. This is manifestation. And the whole of manifestation is characterized by what we, as we are, rightly call change, a becoming process, which means that the infinite variety which constitutes this one single cosmos, all the bits and pieces, as we would say, each comes to birth, each progresses, lives its life, and passes away. We say it perishes, it dies. But we say that because we are ignorant. There is no such thing as perishing in the sense of annihilation. Nothing is annihilated. You can't throw anything out of the cosmos. Quite impossible. There is change. To use that lovely little sentence by Shakespeare, when he's talking to Ferdinand, the prince, about his father who was shipwrecked. They were all shipwrecked. And this spirit, Ariel, the mischievous little spirit, the jolly little spirit, says to Ferdinand, of him, that is, your father, nothing doth remain, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Note, nothing remains when the change is complete, but there has been no perishing, no annihilation. You see, it's just transformed into something rich and strange. Now we must bear that in mind, otherwise we get a wrong view of death, and we think of our coming to fruition and development as if it were climbing the steps of a ladder. It is not like that at all. This transformation process of the entire cosmos is one in which there is no annihilation. Because this primordial creative energy, out of the state of quiescence, by self-restriction, produced form and shape, and with it time, space and matter. You see how wonderful it becomes. This transcendent creative energy never compels anything. If you study the religious texts of the great religions of the world, you will find this extraordinary statement. There is the presentation of God and the devil, of good and evil. And in every case, the devil is never annihilated. In every religion you will find that the good God shuts up the devil for 1,000 years, as they say, and then he's let loose again. You find this in Revelation, the book of Revelation. He's not destroyed. You find it in Zarathustrian teaching, that there comes the spell of time, the period of time, when the devil's activities subside, and then again it all starts up. How? Why is it said, put in that form? Because this extraordinary process of activity and manifestation and the period of rest, they observe a certain balanced rhythm. That is why. So now, this transcendence which goes right beyond any sort of imagination, any sort of spiritual perception that the most perfected holy ones amongst us could ever have, this presents transcendence in its own realm, at its own level, so to say, as something which is quiet and free, the uttermost freedom, the peace of God which passes understanding. And then that peace is deliberately enclosed, constricted, in order to produce a cosmos. That is the, as far as I'm aware, the deepest way in which these things have been presented. So transcendence never compels. Eckhart's Gottheit is non-compulsive. In the process of constriction, of limitation, Gottheit releases the manifestation, the ideal, and the living image of perfection that you and I call God, the absolute good. And now, this God, Elohim, and Yahweh Elohim, produces man in his own living image. Elohim is this creative power in activity, this energy. Yahweh is that same energy lying hidden, sleeping, dormant within yourself. Neither Elohim nor Yahweh compel. The energy is there, waiting to be released. And this is where man, you and I, come in the extraordinary way that we come into the story, in the evolution of life on this planet at least. And the extraordinary way is due to the fact that you and I have the power to say no to God, to say yes to Mephistopheles. And just as, by the same token, we have the power to say no to Mephistopheles and yes to God. It's like that. Why should this be the case? How is it that this is the case? Man, you and I, that is, as we are, have the power to look within and recognize an individual self. Can a fly do that? Can a bee do that? Can a stone do that? It's only you or I who can do that. Look within and recognize an individual self. An individual self which is possessed of its own desires, its own particular feelings according to the state of its development, which has the power to make tools, to exercise some sort of control over nature, and if he is wise, to control himself, which he never does. You see, it is this individual self which has that power, this withinness. And that which is outside the withinness, that which we say is the without, is what is called the not self. Now, this withinness, if and when we wake up to the fact that transcendence is embodied in us, this withinness is the very thing that makes this particular organism, which bears our own name, a true microcosm. Now you see the meaning of the word man. the meaning of the word mind. The microcosm is a complete, but not yet perfect, representative, a living representative of the total macrocosm, the great cosmos. We are a little cosmos. And this is the mystery, the wonder and the marvel of transcendence. That the microcosm and the macrocosm are an identity. We see it as separate because we can't see fully. We can't think about it properly. We are unawake to the relationship between microcosm and macrocosm. Because remember, when one really sees this, all the constriction disappears and your vision becomes utterly free and transcendental. And then space, time and matter exercise no restriction upon our vision, our spiritual vision, and our capacity to be in mind itself, transcendental mind, and in spirit, just exactly what this ultimate creative energy is. This is our divine potentiality. So now, is this divine potentiality fully manifest in us? The few remarkable human beings through the ages, they who had become the truly perfected holy ones in all cultures and in all climates and places, in them this had become realized. Now, it was not the result of effort by the microcosm, those particular perfected holy ones, to achieve this. This is another great mistake we make. Transcendence is right beyond our petty ideas of achievement and attainment. Achievement and attainment and getting something for yourself are the puerilities, the childishnesses of the immature being, the subhuman being. And we, still being unrealized, therefore, and somewhere between our pure animal ancestor and realized transcendence, I call subhuman. But this is not to insult the human race. It is just stating the fact that we are less than what Elohim made us. That is all. We have to grew into that, not achieve it, not attain it. Lucifer tried to achieve it, to attain it, to say, I am equal with you, O God. But supposing we say that, what do we imply? You, God, and I are separate, and I am as good as you. But the fundamental fact is the absolute unitary, whole, one total reality. It is a unitary whole. And if I aspire to equality with God, I am just stupid, ignorant, evil. Because if I have capacity and use it to bring into being, preserve, and maintain separation, I am doing evil. And the greater power I have to do that, the greater the devil I am. You see, some somewhat along these lines, we can begin to glimpse what we are, where we are, what is the relationship of the different factors which compose us, and our interrelationships with each other, with the whole cosmos, and the way in which we are seated in the heart of transcendence itself, with the everlasting arms underneath us, upholding us, sustaining us. And that transcendence is always over and above and beyond us too. Then there is no conceit, then there is no egoism at all. Even if the brain, which is so backward in these matters, could see with a clarified intellect something of the truth of these things, even if that could happen, our egoism, our vanity, our passionate activity through our daily life, which keeps us in that sinful state of separation from reality and totality, would disappear. Now you see, this is something that cannot be attained or achieved. You can achieve something in the world of things if you have skill, a great gift as a maker of fine violins, like Stradivarius had, for instance, you see. Well, all right, that is an achievement. But that, as is perfectly obvious, is in the realm of the finite. It is something. It is in the realm of that which comes into being, it is made, it lasts for such and such a time, a day, a century, 1,000 years, but then it changes. But this is beyond all change, beyond all transformation. When even the intellect can really sense it, and the brain can be still and silent, and the voice of selfness is utterly quiet, when that happens, then there is immediate realization of the state of communion, not with the divine, but in the divine. In this union, there is no separation between God and man. And yet the mystery, man is not lost in God, not lost in the infinite. This is an extraordinary union. As long as you are alive, as long as the organism alive, your identity remains. But as I suggested this morning, when the river meets the ocean, where will you find the river? When the Rhine or the Danube empties itself into the great ocean, which part of that great ocean will you pick out and say, ah, this is a bit of the Rhine? You can't. You see? And yet, the extraordinary thing, that the microcosm, which embodies the macrocosm, and both of them, which embody transcendence itself, are an identity. Now you realize, this is quite beyond all brain logic. Brain logic cannot get at it. And it is very interesting to note that great teachers like the Buddha quietly said that the teaching of the truth is something which is very deep, hard to understand. It is beyond dialectic, beyond argumentation, beyond logic, but that truth is excellent. It is sweet. It is something which can be realized by the pure one, the holy one. Now, when I say something by the pure one, it really means that the truth just shines through him. And when it shines through him like that, he doesn't know it. He is unself-conscious, but wholly conscious, wholly awake. And this is the meaning of the word human, the man part of it. Now, the prefix human, we say, a human being. In the Avestan language, the prefix hu is the equivalent of the Sanskrit su, su, hu and su. When Zarathustra gave out his teachings, the great trinity, so to say, of commandments is not a right word, the moralities as they were laid down, were good thought, but thought not just this chatter in the brain which goes on, but the good mind, you see. Humata, the good mind, which is the divine mind. And the divine mind creates and sees and says it is good. In that sense, the good mind, the good thought, hu ukta, hukta, which means the good word. The significance of the word is the bringing into being of the microcosm which embodies the macrocosm, which is transcendence itself embodied. That is why the word, speech, becomes so important. Very, very important. This is its, if you like, transcendent origin. That is why when a man gives his word, he must never break his word. He must fulfill it. And he must never give it unless he knows that he can fulfill it. Just think how different our world would be if we really understood this. Isn't most of the harm in the world done through speech? Gossip, slander, plans for somebody else's or a nation's destruction, or whatever it is. Speech, speech, speech all along the line. Think of the so-called diplomatic services. How cleverly they use speech for purposes which in some respects promote harmony, but in most respects produce disharmony, because that speech is used for the benefit of one's own nation as against another nation. Think of it. Therefore, hukta, humata, hukta, and hu vrashta. Vrashta means action. Now, when thought in its transcendental sense and speech in its sense of the wielding of power and the consequent action, when they are all there together, you've got the perfection of the microcosm embodied. So, human, it means not only the good, but it means something else also. And it is in this other sense that the meaning of hu and su is most apparent in the religious teachings and the religious statements. It means happy. they talked of the Buddha as the Sugata. The Sanskrit uses S-U, you see, not H-U. In human, we have the H-U, that is the Avastan form. Sugata, he who has gone happily. He is the blessed one, the fortunate one. This is the transcendental origin of the goddess of fortune, which you have in all the cultures of the world. There is the goddess of fortune. And this is the fortune referred to. The hymns of the Rig Veda, and the Rig Veda is the oldest religious monument of our Indo-European race, you see. The hymns of the Rig Veda are filled with prayers, give us wealth. And of course people, scholars read this and say, oh, they were such a primitive people, they were concerned with having their rice fields and cows and sheep and lots of it. Can you imagine the perfected Holy One being interested in burdening himself with 1,000 cows and 20,000 sheep? Not at all. What is this wealth? Vision, understanding, spiritual wealth, the power to be a center of radiation for all that is good and wonderful and perfect upon the whole world. This is the wealth they prayed for. So you see, human, the happy creator. Am I a happy creator? Are you a happy creator? Have we happy creators in the world? We have hundreds of millions of procreators. Not only biologically, that's nature's power. And nobody must insult nature, because nature is mother, the mother of the whole cosmos. We must never insult nature. We must understand nature and serve nature. Now, this happy creation. What is our expression corresponding to the divine expression of creation? What is our creation, which means and expresses the happy creator? It's not just our cultural creations, the supreme symphonies and quartets and operas and paintings and sculpture and architecture and so forth. They are wonderful, true enough. They are wonderful. But it is not that kind of creation which is implied here in the word human. It is the releasing of the subhuman state in which we are confined, imprisoned, the releasing out of that subhuman state into the fully human state. Then the microcosm is the living representative of transcendence itself on earth. Insofar as transcendence manifests the meaning of manhood in the whole cosmos. When you get the perfect flower, or the perfect soil, the field, when you get anything which is perfect in itself, that is the fulfillment of transcendence. As the perfect flower, the perfect stone, the perfect mountain, the perfect land, the perfect climate, and so forth. It is transcendence which comes to fruition, not you or I. Our happy action, our happy creative action is fundamentally what the world would call inaction. And it's religious, it's psychological, it's practical and sensible meaning of inaction is just this. You do not think, feel, speak, or do anything which emphasizes, produces, maintains separation, the breaking of the unitary wholeness of the one total reality. It is that breaking of the unity, the oneness, which is the fundamental meaning of the word sin. People don't realize that. They think of sin only in the moralistic sense, that you have done something which is immoral or unmoral. We generally use the word immoral mostly in relationship, in connection with sexual morality, and the word unmoral in connection with morality in business, in our relationship with our neighbors, or the law, or whatever it is. You do nothing like that. You refrain from that. Now just consider, supposing we did refrain from it, how many of the activities, the present day activities of the world, go on? Have you ever tried to imagine that? One of my dearest friends from my Cambridge days, from 1921 onwards, he died last year. One of my dearest friends became a lawyer first, and then, because he had the gift, he became chairman of one of the great stores in London. And we used to see each other very often. He used to invite me to his country home for a weekend. And I asked him once, and he was a good philosopher and a little bit of a poet also. I asked him once, if the business world was not involved with the vanity of human beings and the power lust of human beings, their egoism, how much business would there be in the world? So he took two or three minutes, then he looked at me and quietly said, I should imagine something like 95% of the world's business would come to an end. 95%. Now, this man had a first-class brain, very well balanced. He could see all sides of the question. Then he looked at me and said, why do you ask the question? How do you think human beings would live and get on if 95% of it came to an end? So I suggested to him, it may be that they might find the right scope, the right means, and the right ways of action which brought well-being, health, happiness, wisdom, love, goodness into their lives. And he paused for a long while and then said, I believe you.